Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, March 16th, 2014. This is episode 1066. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile from Citrix. Try ShareFile today for a free 30-day trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone, and enter Tech Guy. And by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial now. ZipRecruiter.com/tech guy. That's ZipRecruiter.com/tech guy. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple or Android carrier product is worth at Gazelle.com. Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the number if you want to talk. We were just exclaiming, Kim Schaefer and I, that Heather Hammond, who is, as you may know, on vacation, she's our normal phone ranger, did in fact, I challenged her. She went to Africa, and we were talking selfies, and I challenged her, saying, you need to get a selfie with a lion. She did.
She did.
If you go to her Facebook page, Heather Hum. I mean, the lion's not, like, right in her lap or anything.
No, how far away is that?
But we want her back, so it's probably close enough. It looks like, I don't know, it's hard to tell with a camera, maybe 50 feet. Safe distance. She seems to be in a conveyance of some kind that could probably outrun the lion should it suddenly attack. She got a really good one with her and an elephant even closer. So welcome, welcome, Kim Schaefer. And this is your last day. Well, Heather, yeah. Barring being mauled, Heather will return next week.
Yeah, I'll be back sometime when she decides
to
take another.
We love having you. You're doing a great job. You're wearing St. Patrick's Day green. Can you believe 5 days till spring, one day to St. Patrick's Day? It's suddenly winter seems to be coming to an end. Thank goodness. When you call 8888-ASK-LEO, you will talk to Kim, and she will prepare you for the airwaves. Put your makeup on, make sure your nose isn't shiny, you know, that kind of thing. Glue down those cowlicks. I think she forgot to do that for me today. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. Our website is at techguylabs.com. Should you go there, you'll see a link to our fine chat room. The chat room is a great place to go, usually between 800 and 1,000 people there. It goes fast. Don't be scared. Don't be put off by the speed. But it is a great place to go to kind of help me, if you hear a question and you say, I know, Mr. Laporte, you can raise your hand. You don't have to raise your hand. You can shout out the answer. It also is a great place to go to get help or to just talk to other listeners to the show. TechGuyLabs.com. Somebody called yesterday and said, is this a terrible thing? The U.S. just lost control of the internet. No, it's not. It's not a terrible thing. It's probably a good thing. At least that's what Vince Cerf, the father of the internet, who now works at Google, is a chief scientist at Google, says. ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, has until now really been running with kind of under the aegis of the U.S. government. Because the internet began here. Of course, it's a global thing, and it isn't really shouldn't be controlled by any government. But just kind of for historic reasons, it began here. In fact, it was a guy at the University of Southern California, John Postel, who was the guy when you wanted to set up a web server or a network on the internet, you would go to John and say, John, give me a number, and he'd give you a domain number. You know, one of those 192.1.1 numbers. He was running a group called IANA. What did that stand for? Internet Assigned Names and Numbers or something like that. IANA gave way to the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers a few years later, and John passed away. But the group running ICANN, the National U.S. National Telecommunications and Information Administration, really has been coming under a lot of pressure, thanks mostly to the revelations of the NSA spying on people. And as a result, they're saying, okay, all right, I get it. You know, the rest of the world doesn't really want this to be a U.S. thing. And that's a good thing. It shouldn't really be part of any country. Vint Cerf, who is really, in many ways, I mean, the Internet has many fathers. But Vint Cerf said, this is good. No one government should be responsible for governance of the Internet. It should be a group thing. And Vint Cerf was the chairman of IANA for a long time. He certainly has, he knows what he's talking about. And I think especially because of suspicion of the U.S., this is probably a good thing. So those who were saying, oh my, is the United Nations going to control the Internet? No. No. The United Nations, lowercase u, lowercase n, the nations that use the Internet will. There have been moves from some governments like Russia to control the Internet themselves. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen. So no fear. Do not worry. And I'll tell you, it is a global Internet. I just saw this. The Chinese search engine, Alibaba. This is the Google of China.
Type in twit.tv. Library.
The Google of China is going to go public and raise money. It's really more than just Google. They also sell stuff. They also do transactions. And they're going to raise money in the U.S. They're going to have an IPO on the U.S. stock exchanges. They're hoping to get a valuation of $130 billion.
Woo!
Alibaba is really the company that powers Yahoo in some ways, at least financially. Yahoo, part owner in Alibaba, will benefit considerably from that. So it is. It's a global world, but they do come to the U.S., don't they? They do come to the U.S. if, you know, they want to raise money. Or if they just want to. I think the U.S. is still kind of the place you go if you want to get acceptance. If you're a startup and you're in, you know, Finland or the U.K., success in the U.S. Same thing with music. Remember in the old days, if you were a musician, if you were the Beatles, you weren't really big until you made it in the U.S. iOS 7.1 came out. If you're using an iPhone or an iPad, run. Do not walk. Run and update. You won't, at least so far, I don't think Apple's been pushing it on you. You have to actually go into your settings. And in the settings general tab, there's a software update page. Go there and it'll say, oh, you know, your software, it'll either say your software's up to date, or it'll say, oh yeah, you can upgrade. Now you can't, not everybody can upgrade, only later models of the iPad and the iPhone, but it is well worth it. It fixes a lot of problems with iOS 7.0. Some battery life issues we're hearing with 7.1, however, resetting resetting the phone seems to fix that. So it seems like when you do the upgrade, there's some cruft left over, and if you reset the phone, all becomes well again. So that's worth checking out. There's some some nice cosmetic features in iOS 7. They're continuing. iOS 7.0 was rushed, let's face it. 7.1 fixes a lot of the things that were rushed about it. So if you're having battery life issues, if you did upgrade to 7.1, again, settings, go to the general tab. At the very bottom, there's a reset button. Now, don't erase all content and settings unless you want to start over like you got it from the factory. It's reset all settings. That will, you'll have to re-enter passwords and so forth, but that apparently fixes the battery life issue that people have had. One of the things that really fixes 7.1 is the, we called it respringing, but the iPad and the iPhone would start up again and again. They have fixed that. Thank goodness. So any of those things we could talk about? You want to talk about Bitcoin and what's happening there? We could talk about that. Still no you know, more information about the founder of Bitcoin. Newsweek said they discovered who it is. Nobody's proved it otherwise. Nobody's come forward saying, no, it's me. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk tech. You, me, and the world. Right after this. Hey, our show today brought to you by ShareFile.com. I use ShareFile all the time because I have to send commercials and, you know, hi, this is Leo Laporte, and you should be listening to Tech Guy on KFIR in beautiful Muncie. I have to send those out to the radio stations. I think in business is probably fairly common these days. There's probably most business emails have an attachment of some kind, a contract, a spreadsheet, PowerPoint presentation, that kind of thing. But you know what I say about attachments. Do not under any circumstances send email attachments. There's a lot of reasons why they're a bad idea. First of all, they're not safe. In fact, I tell people not to open attachments. And then people always say to me, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm a business. I need to send attachments. Well, I got a solution for you. But most viruses come in through email attachments. So that's problem number one. Problem two, if you are sending email attachments, anybody along the way can read it. I don't care what disclaimers you put at the bottom of the email. Anybody along the way can read it, so it's not secure. And, of course, there's always the issue, especially as these attachments get bigger and bigger, with bounce back. You know, you can't send giant files through email. That's why I use ShareFile with all the radio stations. ShareFile is fantastic. It is a secure way to send files. You're really sending a link, not an attachment. Although, if you use Outlook, their plugin makes it look just like you're attaching files. You send a link. They have synchronization, so I have ShareFile folders on my desktop. In fact, I'll show you. I have one for KFI and one for the network. And so in here, these folders contain, you know, copy, recordings, and all of that stuff. Here's the radio station. You know, these are the kind of things I send off to the radio stations. Hi, it's me, Leo Laporte, and you are listening to The Tech Guy. Weekends on 1340 KVOT and 1340kvot.com. So I got to send that to them, right? And I don't know what tech literacy and so forth they have. So these I record them here on the computer. I save them into those folders. They're automatically synchronized with the ShareFile synchronization program. So they're automatically uploaded to the ShareFile cloud. And then it's very easy for me to share them. I'll show you how I do this. I go to ShareFile. I go to my account. And by the way, it's branded, which is so nice. You see the Twit logo and everything. So it doesn't look like they don't get puzzled when they see this. They go, oh, this is from Leo. They know. And I can say, okay, I want to share this file. You can have regular users. I want to share. Yeah, I'll take a file and show you what happens. So here's there's nothing in that folder. Let's do recordings. How about that? Yeah. So here's a DSL Extreme spot. Okay. I'll click those three. I'll say send. Now, I can send it as an email from their web-based email attach thing, but I like to do this. Send a link, and I can control it. I can say email when the item's been downloaded. I can require them to enter their name and email. I can say how long access goes from forever to never. Well, I guess down to a day. How many downloads they can have. Once I set those, I say send files, and I'm going to get a secure link that I can now attach to my email. I just copy to the clipboard and paste it. And I like to do that because then I can use my own email program and so forth. Let me show you what they get, though, when they click that link. They literally get a download form with my logo on it, the names of the files. They can click the download button. They all download. It really couldn't be easier. I love ShareFile. I know you want to use ShareFile. If you're in business, you want to tell the boss, this is how we ought to do it. Here's what we're going to do for you. We're going to get you a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com. The very top podcast listeners, click here. Click that link, if you would. And then make sure you tell them you heard about it on the Tech Guy Show. Do select your industry because it's HIPAA compliant. It is regulations in many industries are supported. It's really good that way. ShareFile.com. Click the microphone at the top of the page and enter the offer code TECHGUY for 30 days free. Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. This is The Tech Guy Show. We talk about computers and the internet and home theater, smartphones, of course, digital photography, and more. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Kim Schaefer has lined up a wonderful panel. This is like American Idol now. We have our top 13, and now you, America, get to vote And I want everybody to... No, they don't sing for us, do they? I got the wrong show.
I've heard their voices.
Yeah. Who should I speak to first?
Well, first we'll actually go local here, Todd in Petaluma.
He's got a question
about Apple ID with having kids and multiple devices and when you should buck up and get another one.
Buck up. We are in Petaluma, California, a little tiny town, the chicken and egg capital of the world north of San Francisco. And so is Todd. Hi, Todd.
Hi there.
How's the chickens? How's the eggs?
What is that? Eggs and bacon?
Our butter and eggs day parade is next month.
Coming up.
It's the funniest little thing because the town's about 55,000 people. It's a little town. And pretty much everybody's in the parade. So in order to have an audience, we all line up, we sit, we watch, the parade goes by, then we join it, and that goes around in a circle. And that way everybody gets to be in it and be spectators. It's great. It's very egalitarian.
Yeah.
Todd, what can I do for you today?
Question is, as you get more and more devices, you have one Apple ID.
And you have kids. Yeah.
And I've turned my old iPhones into iPods for them. And, I have 320 apps and lots of music.
Every Apple device can have two IDs, and it's probably a good idea to at least have two IDs, one for the store. That's why they have the shared ID, right? Because you don't want to buy something several times on each device. So
yeah, at some point you have to, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but it's fine. Yeah, I think there's a limited number of devices, but it's pretty high number. I can't remember. Is it five? I don't remember what it is, but five or six.
I don't know what the number is either, but it's the money, at what age or how many devices at some point. So I didn't know you could have two IDs.
Yeah, so that's the solution to this, which is have a common Apple Store ID. And, of course, you're going to keep that password yourself because you don't want kids buying $50,000 worth of fish in their aquarium game. You're going to keep that to yourself. It's actually it's a large number. It's 10 devices and 5 computers. So it could be 5 computers, 5 devices, 1 computer, 9 devices like that.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. That's a lot. At some point it'll say, hey, you've got too many. You can't authorize another device, and then you'll have to deauthorize a device and move on. The trick on that is to remember to deauthorize when you take something out of service. I always forget this. Because Apple only lets you reset once a year. You can reset all of it. You can say, I want everybody to have to log back in. And that way you can start over, start fresh. But I think that's enough devices, unless you have an awfully large family. So
That sounds right. I wonder about the privacy issue, because if you're using your Apple ID on each of their devices.
So then there's PhotoStream and the other stuff, right? So that's a different ID, and you can have those are free. You can have as many as you want. Every kid can have his own. That's not the store ID. There's a store logon. Having one is a good idea, because then when you buy a song, it's all the kids can play it. When you buy an app, all the kids can play it. You don't have to buy it 5 times. And Apple allows that. So that's your store ID. There's another ID. They call it the iCloud ID, but it's the same thing as your mobile me account was, and then they changed it to Mac.com, and they keep changing. Now it's iCloud. You can have – those are all free, and you can have as many of those as you want. Might not be a bad idea for each kid to have their own iCloud account. And here's why. You use iCloud for backup. If they take pictures on their phone, it goes to their iCloud account. If you want all the pictures in one place, then maybe you want to share an iCloud account. But most people don't. My son is in college. I don't want to see his frat party pictures on my photo stream anymore. I thought for a while, oh, this will be good. I can keep an eye on him. No, I don't want to know what's going on. So he has a separate iCloud ID. But when he buys music or I buy music, we can share that music. So two IDs on each device. One is your iCloud ID. That's where the backup goes. That's where the photo stream goes. And then one is the Apple Store account, and that's a separate account. That'll solve it. Trust me.
That seems to answer it. Your own chat will be under, if you have any chats.
Yeah. That's another big issue. Yeah. If you use iMessage, they used to call it, to chat with people, That's via iCloud ID, not Apple Store ID. So that's very important. You don't want those texts to go to your kids or vice versa. And you want them to be able to text you through messages and know who it is. Otherwise, it all looks like you. So absolutely, absolutely. Each the messages is another thing that is
messages would fall under the
iCloud,
not the iStore,
not App Store. Yep.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's not intuitive. Apple doesn't really make it super clear, but they do. You can, if you go into settings, you see you can do that, and it's important to do. I would do that. Same thing when you log into a Macintosh and. You have to look quick, but there is a chance to use a different account for the store, for the App Store, and the login on a Macintosh. So it's true of a Macintosh when you first set it up, or later after the fact, you can change that ID. And Jeff is reminding me, messages can come from a phone number. Apple's messages is so broken, though. First of all, he's got people, you know, kids with iPads and iPod Touches, as well as, I presume, iPhones. So you're right. The phone number can be your ID, but it uses more than just the phone number. You use your iCloud account, too. It's goofy. I don't even know. I have a phone number on my Apple Apple ID that is not mine. When my mom tries to FaceTime me, she gets some other guy. And he's really, at this point, fed up. He says, stop calling me. I'm not your son. She goes, Leo, is that you? No. Come on, Leo. I know it's you. No. Stop calling me. So, and I don't know how that number got there, and I don't know how to get rid of it. It's not obvious. So it's probably a good idea to have separate iCloud IDs and App Store IDs, and everybody should have their own. Messages is a mess. Messages is a mess. They've just ruined it completely. It's completely unusable, in my opinion. Plus, it has the additional flaw of being Apple-centric. And since, you know, not everybody in the world owns an iPhone. You should call me more. I don't even know you, lady. No, I know. This is my son. No, it's not your son. This is the reason to have separate IDs. Robert Charleston. I'm thinking North Carolina, but I could be wrong. Hi, Robert.
Hey, it's South Carolina, but
South. They're right next to each other. Sorry about that. Yeah, South Carolina.
That's true.
I didn't do well in geography, as you can tell.
Neither am I, but that's why I got my GPS and my phone.
So you know, that's right.
I came across a deal earlier this week on the Moto App Maker. Or if you have an EDU account, you can get the Moto X.
Isn't that exciting? Hey, we got to take a break. Hang on. I want to talk about the Moto X, the Moto G, too. But we do have to break for the bottom of the hour. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, you'll be back in a moment, Robert. Thanks. Johnny Jett is down under. If I were him, I'd be down under my desk. It's 5:30 a.m. in Sydney. He's in Australia right now. Hi, Johnny. He's our travel guru. Tell us why. Tell us why you're in Australia.
I am here for the Dodgers game, playing the Diamondbacks over the weekend. Actually, I think the Dodgers should be on a plane now or getting ready to get
on. Is it their season opener? No.
It is the first game of Major League Baseball.
It's a regulation game.
Regulation game. It's going to be next Saturday and Sunday. So they got a few days. I think on Friday night I'm going to see them play the Australia national team.
Oh, that'll be fun. Because baseball is not exactly the big sport in Australia. So it'd be like watching them play a bunch of high school students.
My taxi driver, you know, I asked him if he was excited. He goes, we're starting to. And I go, have you ever heard of Derek Jeter? He's like, nope.
Nope.
He hasn't heard of any baseball player.
No, of course not. NFL does this too, right? They play a game in London. The idea is to kind of grow the base. But I got to say the best sport in the world is Australian rules football, footy. While you're there, go take in a footy game, and then you tell me.
Those guys are crazy.
It's amazing.
I played lacrosse in college, and that's a tough sport.
Yeah, but you had pads.
Australian rules is nothing compared to that. Those guys are the real.
Well, on the one hand, you had pads, but you also had sticks. They don't have sticks.
I'm still limp because of
Johnny has a good tip, but not a useful tip, but a good tip for those who are going to Australia. This is what you did to avoid jet lag.
Avoid jet lag. And if you're afraid of those really long, super long flights, go through Hawaii. I flew Hawaiian Airlines, and they have free stopovers in both directions. So from New York, it's a 10-hour flight to Honolulu, and then another 10-hour flight to Sydney. From the woman next to me last night was from San Francisco. She flew, you know, 5 hours from San Francisco, and then another 10. And it's just, and you land, instead of landing at 7 a.m., when you take the Hawaiian flight, you land at 7 p.m.
So you're almost ready for bed, yeah.
You are. I stayed up the whole flight and worked.
Yeah. And now you're, so you've been there one night and you're already acclimated.
I just got here. I got here. I landed at 7 p.m. last night. It's 5:30 Monday morning now. 5:35.
What is your trick for jet lag? Do you have one? Everybody, you're such a frequent flyer. You must have some trick.
Well, my nickname is Johnny Jetlag, and I actually own the domain. But it
do you really?
Yeah.
So are you permanently jet lagged?
Perpetually, but everyone's different. But my best advice is just get on local time as soon as possible. When the plane takes off, I change my watches to local time, and I try to stay on it. That was a day flight. Some people on the plane were sleeping. I'm like, you guys
big mistake because they're going to be up all night. Yeah.
So I worked the whole flight.
And do you do melatonin or anything like that?
No, I don't take anything. Nothing like that.
Yeah.
You know. Right, and when I land, especially if it's at night, I go for a walk. I try to stay awake to at least 10 or 11 p.m., and then I take a hot shower, and I'm ready to go to sleep.
I think getting some sunlight, too, if it's daylight when you get there, letting your body know, hey, you think it's night, but see that sun over there? That's daytime. Yeah.
If you land in the morning, get sunlight.
Reset your body clock.
And there's actually an app for that, and I'm spacing on the name. I've written about it before. I'll have to bring it up next week.
Your newsletter has some great jet lag tips, I'm told.
For sure. I have a daily tip newsletter as well where I talk about everything. You know.
Sign up at johnnyjet.com, by the way.
Talking about some tips.
Yeah.
You see, United Airlines is now going to offer free in-flight movies for Apple devices starting next month.
So you bring your iPad or iPhone. Is that how it works?
For right now, and they're going to have 150 movies and 200 TV shows preloaded, and you can download them
via the Wi-Fi on the plane.
No, yes, but you don't have to pay for it. It's going to be tricky because if everyone's doing it, I mean, how much bandwidth are they going to have?
Yeah,
but not all planes
have
it.
I think they're going to have to pay Comcast for extra access to the passengers.
I think what it means is that they're going to start taking away their own IFE, their in-flight entertainment systems.
Why not? When you get on a plane these days, most people are looking at their tablet, not at the little screen in the back of the seat in front of them, really.
Right, and that costs a lot of money, and they're heavy.
It's heavy.
So they want to get rid of them. So I think this is what that means. Also, I found a website for you because you asked me last time about going to Costa Rica. And I said, I don't think you should go in June or July because I think it's rainy season. So check out weatherbase.com.
Weatherbase.com.
It's a nasty looking website. It's old. It's but it has some
ugly
good information.
Ugly site.
So just type in Costa Rica and then or even Los Angeles. I typed in Los Angeles and it gives you so many different options.
So you can see what the weather is year round.
Whatever city you go into.
What the average temperature, average precip, length of day, number of rainy days. See, Costa Rica has 284 rainy days a year. Wow, 264.
That's why you don't want to go during the rainy season. And I was right because it is June and July and August.
Yeah.
So the better time would be, March when they only get an inch of rain.
Yeah. Well, yeah, March and February and March are good times to go to Costa Rica.
And April, yep.
All right, I'm out of here. I'll see you later, Johnny. I'm off to Costa Rica for St. Patrick's Day.
We'll talk about St. Patrick's
Day. July, 10 inches of rain.
Last night.
Do they celebrate St. Patrick's Day in Australia?
Oh, man. In Australia, they'll celebrate anything.
Pretty much if there's drinking involved, any holiday in Australia is an Australian holiday. I was there.
I will definitely be taking my phone into a pub tomorrow and taking some pictures, or today.
I was there a year ago for the Melbourne Cup, which is a big horse race. And the entire country shuts down. It's
national holiday.
Yeah. It's amazing.
I know.
It's amazing. It really is. I have to say I envy you because Australia is one of my favorite countries. Where are you going to go? Are you just going to stay there in Sydney?
No, I'm leaving Sydney tomorrow to get out of the country. I'm going out into the countryside and then I'm coming back for the baseball game.
Fun.
And it's just you know, I walked around last night. The weather is perfect. It's late fall here. Actually, it's late summer turning into fall. So the leaves are falling on the ground. It's just mind-boggling.
It's a beautiful city.
Think about it.
If you get a chance, go on the Sydney Harbour Bridge. They have a bridge climb. Have you done that?
I've been afraid to do
it. Oh, don't be afraid. They take all the bits that could fall off of you.
They strap you in and put you in a jumpsuit. The one time I did it, I actually had two chances once. One time I chickened out. The other time it was terrible weather.
JohnnyJet.com, at JohnnyJet if you want to follow him. And if you want pictures of Australia, he's already posted some. His Instagram is JohnnyJet. He joins us every week to talk about travel. I guess we'll talk to you in Australia next week, too. You can give us play-by-play of the Dodgers game.
And hopefully we'll have some closure on this Malaysia flight 370.
Wow, is that it? You know, I had, I didn't want to introduce him, but we in studio audience yesterday was a flight safety officer for a major United States airline. And I said, you guys all must be talking about this. He said, yeah, it's a mystery.
Everybody's talking about it. Yeah. The flight attendants were talking about it yesterday, which is not the best thing you want to hear.
No.
When you're flying over the Pacific, but
this is straight out of the X-Files, folks. I mean,
it's unbelievable. I mean, now the plane flew over Malaysia, and the government didn't say anything.
Wow.
I was actually supposed to be in Malaysia this past week. I changed it to go to Hawaii.
Yeah, I think you did the right thing.
I think I did the right thing.
So Hawaii's nice. Thank you, JohnnyJet. Thank you. Go out, take a run, enjoy the beautiful weather in Sydney, and we'll talk again next week. JohnnyJet.com, the place to go to follow him. And his travels online, he's a great resource. Now, we were talking to Robert. He's in Charleston, South Carolina. And I apologize, Robert, for interrupting you there. So, good news.
Yes.
You but you're in the U.S.
Right.
So, man. You hear that? Right. That means I got to put you on hold again. Hang on, okay?
So worth it.
We are going to talk. My favorite phone, the Moto X. We'll talk it when we talk. Come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We've been trying to answer Robert's call all hour. Robert, you're the patientest man. Is that even a word?
Hey, listen, you and Johnny Jett are probably way more interesting than anything I have to ask. So
no, actually, I like your question because this is something a lot of people probably would like to know. You're choosing a smartphone right now. You've decided on an Android phone.
Right. I used a Windows phone, and it's starting to fall apart on me, and I'm just too geeky. I watch your All About Android show. I want to get more into the apps, and I wanted to be able to do more with my phone. So I love Windows, but they're not moving fast enough for me. So
it's sad because I do think the Windows phone operating system is quite good.
Oh, it's gorgeous, and it's so easy to use, but...
But no apps.
I'm a tinker. I'm a geek and a tinker.
Yeah, so Android's better for the tinkerer.
Absolutely. So I have a choice. Money is not the limiting factor. And I'm thinking Nexus 5 or Moto X, one of the two. And I know you're in love with the Moto X. I mean, the Moto X.
Yeah, I like the Moto X. So in general, I do prefer a cleaner Android experience. Kim, cover your ears right now. She has an HTC One. She has the HTC One, which is a very nice phone. But I have to say, both Samsung and, to a lesser degree, but somewhat of a degree, HTC, over-customize the stuff. They put a lot of their own software on top of it. And so one of the nice things, and the reason people buy Nexus phones is they're from Google, and they're pure. They really are pure Android. You don't get any customizations. Now, some customizations are good. The reason I kind of prefer the Moto X, the Nexus 5 is better in almost every respect. Better camera, better screen. Probably a little bit faster hardware, better hardware. Neither one has a removable battery or room for an SD card slot. So that's a wash on the two phones. But the reason I like the Moto X is it is basically a clean Android experience, but with a few little things that do make a difference. So, for instance, the Moto X is the only phone you can say, okay, Google Now, listen to the Rolling Stones. And it will hear me, it will interpret it, and it will actually, if everything goes right. No, it didn't do it. It's supposed to play the Rolling Stones. So about 50% of the time it doesn't work. No, there's a lot of things you can do. And that's touchless operation, which I really like. You can do that on the Nexus, but you have to touch it once. You have to swipe your finger up.
Do you think that'll come later on? Do you think?
No, it's a hardware thing because it won't, okay. Because it requires it kills the battery to be listening all the time. So the Moto X has an additional low power chip that's doing the listening. It also, while it's lying there, the screen will pulse and show you notifications. There's just some nice features. It knows when you're driving. It knows when you're sleeping. It knows when you've been bad or good. So no. It knows when you're driving. It knows when you're sleeping. It knows when you're in a meeting. It will hold calls. It will answer calls. The best thing, and there are third-party apps that try to do this, but this really does it well. When I'm driving and a text comes in, it will wake up and say, "You just got a text from Kim. Would you like me to read it to you?" And it will read, and I'll say yes. It will read me the text, and then it says, "Would you like to reply?" And you say yes, and you can dictate a message all without touching the phone. So those
that
are
needs
features.
To be standard.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, oh my goodness,
it's wonderful. So if there were a lot of other customizations, Samsung-like customizations, I would say no. But because it's so close to Pure, it's very similar to the Nexus 5, but it has those few little things that make a difference. Now, negatives on the Moto X: it's not a great camera. If you need a good camera, frankly, the HTC One's better. The Samsung Galaxy S4 is better. The Nexus 5 is better. Not much, but it's better. The Moto has one of the worst cameras on a high-end Android phone. It's also got kind of a small, lower-res screen. The Nexus 5 has a bigger screen. It's a little bit higher quality. So, truth is, I have both. I own both. Both are excellent. What carrier are you on?
T-Mobile.
Yeah,
it has to last me at least 2 years.
Yeah. Well, you know there'll be a Nexus 6. The nice thing about the Nexus 5 is cheap.
Yeah.
You buy it unlocked, not from T-Mobile, but from Google, and then you put a T-Mobile SIM in it.
Right.
And so it's unlocked, which means you can travel with it, put another company's SIM in it. It's fine. No problem. You can get an unlocked Moto X, but it's a little more expensive, I think. It's like $50 more expensive. So, I think it's very close. I don't think that there's a clear winner. Either one would make you happy. If you can wait, the Motorola folks say there will be a new Moto X in the summer.
But it'll be back up full price near $500.
Yeah, probably. They did that when it first came out, didn't they? They overcharged for it. And they've got the price way down now. It's around $300, I think. I do think that the improvement they could make is a better camera and a better screen. If they did that, it would be very desirable.
Can I say for all the people that are looking at the Moto X that if you have a .edu account, you can get it for $345
wow.
off contract on the Moto X Maker site. So
that's pretty good, motomaker.com. Now, Google's selling Motorola to Lenovo. I don't think that's a bad thing, but that might – who knows? It might change things a little bit. Let me just look what you can get a Nexus 5. By the way, on both the Motorola X and the Nexus 5, I would, if you can afford it, get 32 gigs. Since it doesn't have the capability of adding memory, I think it's
$400 for the Nexus 5 to add the 32 gigs.
32 gig Nexus 5 is $400. 16 gig is $350. So it's roughly the same. They're in the same ballpark.
So you would go for the bigger size if I can get it.
Well, this summer, I don't even know if there will be a bigger size. I would hope that that's what they would change. So,
I mean, for Nexus 5, get the 32 gig.
Oh, yeah, but get as much storage as you can afford because you can't add storage after the fact. It's only $50
right.
more. So I love the Moto X. I do, although I have to say the new red Nexus 5 is pretty desirable, too.
Yeah.
It's a tough choice. I don't think you'd go wrong with either one. I think those are the differences right there.
Okay, to tail on that, what's your favorite podcast app for Android?
I use Dog Catcher, D-O-G-G.
Okay.
I think it's very good. It logs into your Google account, so it remembers your settings, remembers your podcasts, downloads them. There's a number. I think Instacast is another one. There's a number of them, but I use Dog Catcher.
Perfect.
Hey, thanks for the call.
So
I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for asking. I think it's choosing a phone is so personal now, more even than choosing a computer. It's in your pocket. It's with you all the time. It's something so intimate that I think it's good if you can spend a little time with it, get to know it, take it to dinner, date the phone first if you can before you really commit. Because 2 years is a long time. It is a commitment, isn't it? You are going to be spending a long time with that phone. Be nice to get to know it. Take it out on a date. Kind of really... get to know one another. See how it fits. See how it fits your hand. How you like the screen. All of that. Barbara Chula Vista, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Leo.
So you've got a Windows 7 PC.
Yes.
And you have a problem.
Purchased a refurbished Windows because I wanted to have the run on 7.
Yep.
And I have it. Everything seemed to be fine. When I turn it on, I would get a message that says that the catalyst control center is not supported by the driver version.
Yeah, that's the video, the ATI video card.
Okay. So
you don't need it.
you
don't really need it. The catalyst control center just gives you additional controls. What I would do is go to ATI's site and get the latest driver. You probably just have an old driver.
Okay, I did not have any success because it asked so many questions that I didn't.
Yeah, they make it way more complicated. It's kind of for gamers, really. I'll tell you what, when we come back, I'll give you the web address. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by our friends at ZipRecruiter.com. We used ZipRecruiter when we needed to fill a job fast. ZipRecruiter.com. The best way to post jobs. If you're hiring, which job site would be the best? Do you know? Some, you know, it depends on what you're looking for. Different boards produce different talent. So if you want to fill a position fast with a perfect candidate, the best thing to do, post your job on all the sites. And that's exactly what ZipRecruiter does. With one click, 50-plus job sites at once. Plus on social networks like LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. It's nice, too, because it will add your company logo and color so your job pages look like an extension of your business. You can add unlimited users to your account and create an instant job page on your website, which is fabulous, powered by ZipRecruiter. You can even include a company careers page for your careers link. You're going to love ZipRecruiter. They automatically highlight the best candidates. They come pouring in. You screen them, you rate them, and you hire the right person fast. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/techguy right now. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 100,000 businesses, including Twit. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial when you visit ZipRecruiter.com/techguy. That's ZipRecruiter.com/techguy. If you need to hire somebody, this is the way to do it. We thank ZipRecruiter for helping us fill that job fast and for their support of the Tech Guy show. Try it free for 4 days. They should have our logo up here, shouldn't they? Well, maybe we're not as big as AT&T and Dell and Chevrolet. ZipRecruiter.com/techguy. Well, hey, hey, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers and the internet and home theater. Smartphones coming up at 12:30. Or actually, depends on what time zone you're in, but at 33 and a third after the hour. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, will be joining us to talk about digital photography. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number, 888-827-5536. Or you can just go to techguylabs.com. And the phone number's there, the chat room's there, a lot more. Leo Laporte, techguylabs.com. Barbara in Chula Vista had a new computer, Windows 7, but it says the Catalyst Center is not running. The Catalyst is just software. It's actually a program that AMD distributes with their ATI graphics cards that allow you to kind of fancy control a lot of settings. Mostly gamers want to use that. But if your Catalyst Control Center won't launch and you do want it to launch, my recommendation is just get the latest drivers. And if you go to AMD.com, you'll see a drivers support page. You've got to figure out which video card you have. Do you know, Barbara, off the top of your head?
I do know, and I know how to eventually get to that information, but that was only a part of my question.
Okay, so that's part one. What else?
Okay, what happened in searching for a driver, I was on Microsoft, and I thought I was so safe, but in searching, I now have Driver Detective.
No.
State on my computer, and they will not let me uninstall.
Right. Only get drivers. Yeah, you got it from a third party. So if you Google, I want the ATI Catalyst drivers, you will get sites that are not either AMD's ATI site or Microsoft's ATI site. You'll get a third-party site.
Okay, and it came through Microsoft. So
no, it didn't. No, it didn't. I promise you. It might have looked like Microsoft, but it's not.
Yeah. So my question is, you're going to tell me about the driver, but how do I get this driver detective off?
I would go to add, remove programs, or I guess in Windows 7, it's programs and features control panel.
It won't allow me to do that.
Yeah, so that's not real software. That's malware.
Okay. How do I get rid of it?
Well, you're stuck now.
Really?
Well, you have to reformat and reinstall.
Okay.
There may be ways to get rid of that specific thing. I'm very concerned, though, that you have that and something other stuff may be on there as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So very, very – something everybody – this is a really good object lesson. I'm sorry this happened to you, Barbara. But you've got to be extraordinarily careful about where you get your software from. And never, ever, ever get software from somewhere that's not the original source. Never. You might, if you're lucky, you might be able to get rid of this by booting into safe mode, Barbara. So reboot, hold down the shift key while you're rebooting. Go to safe mode with networking on the startup menu. Then programs and features in the control panel and see if you can remove it then. There are malware programs that will remove it. But the problem is, if I tell you one, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to Google it. You're going to go to a phony site and you're going to download something even worse. So it's, it's not good. There is I'm told the chat room says malware bytes will remove it, but you've got to get it from the right source. It's malwarebytes.org. If you go to some other site with, quote, malware bytes, you're going to have the same problem you just had. You thought you were downloading from Microsoft. You weren't. You thought you were downloading a driver. You weren't. You were downloading malware. I just really cannot emphasize this enough. Bad guys, in order to get on your system, have to get you to run a program. That's where the malware payload lies. In order to get you to run that program, they have to trick you. So one way they do that is they create a site that's a driver site. And when you download a driver from there, you're getting other stuff, like this driver detective, which you don't want. And any time you get something you can't remove, that's a big red flag. People get malware in your system, don't want you to remove it, right? If you a legitimate program will do a couple of things. First, it'll ask you before it installs itself, do you want to install driver detective? And you'll have to say yes. And then it will add an entry into your programs and features control panel that lets you uninstall it cleanly, completely. If a program does that, I mean, it can still be malicious in a way, like adware, but at least you can get rid of it. If you can't get rid of it and it didn't ask you, it is malware with a capital M. Majorgeeks.com has a lot of suggestions on how to remove this stuff. That's a safe site. Majorgeeks.com, bleepingcomputer.com also. These are good sites with lots of resources. But again, I'd be very, very, very careful. It's so easy to download something that looks like a malware removal tool, quacks like a malware removal tool, waddles like a malware removal tool, and is malware, not a removal tool. And this driver is not a legit driver. Unfortunately, what we've always thought of as legitimate sites like cnetsdownload.com, they're doing it too. Really is unfortunate. Do not get drivers from third-party sites. Get them from the manufacturer's site or Microsoft. And I think you thought you were on Microsoft, but I guarantee you, given what you got, you were not. The best way to install drivers from Microsoft is to use Windows Update, not to go to a website, but to use Windows Update. And, this is so fundamental. It's why I despair, because April 8th, less than a month from now, Microsoft's not going to support Windows XP anymore. And there are almost 500 million XP users out there. And I guarantee you most of them do not know the basics of safe computing. which means they're all going to get bit bad. It is possible to use Windows XP safely. It's possible to use Windows safely. But nothing, not antivirus software, nothing can protect you against yourself. If you go to a website and download something and say, no, I want to install this, the antivirus is going to say, okay, well, you insist. Go right ahead. And now you got something bad on there. I feel terrible, Barbara, but probably the best thing to do is find a smart support guy. Go somewhere, you know, Best Buy, get the Geek Squad or somebody to run the malware removal tools on your systems. And the best way, frankly, to do this is to reinstall Windows completely and cleanly. But I'm guessing on that refurb computer you didn't get a copy of Windows. So please burn this into your brain. Do not always, always, always get your software from the original source of the software. Always. Not from download.com, not from superdriversite.com. Always from the original manufacturer, in this case, AMD and ATI. Kevin in Iowa, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Say, I need to purchase a new camera, and I'm not exactly sure. I've never had anything other than a point-and-shoot before, and I want to. It's mainly for my wife, but I want to move her up to a digital DSL.
Good.
And I want to, but I hear all these terms you talk about, the full-frame sensor, mirrorless. I've done some research, and just the sensor types. Is it CMOS, CCD? I don't know any of it.
All right, they're all CMOS now.
Right.
And the bigger the sensor, the better, but more expensive and more bulky the camera is. So the biggest sensors, the biggest affordable sensors are full frame sensors. Those are in the high end professional DSLRs. Those are the size of a 35 millimeter negative. That's why they call them full frame. But those are expensive. Hang on, because this is a great topic, and I'd like to spend some more time with you talking about it right after this break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, how to buy a camera. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Kevin wants to buy his wife a new camera. He wants to step up a little bit to a higher-end camera. By the way, Chris Marquardt's joining us in about 10 minutes, so I'll ask him as well, Kevin. But let me give you some of the basics so you understand what the terms are. So we talk about the frame size. The reason we talk about the frame size is because the bigger the sensor, the more light you can capture, so the better it works in low light. You can also have more megapixels, which means you can have a higher quality image, although you can't go crazy on megapixels. You know, too many megapixels isn't good either, but having more megapixels is not a bad thing in general, up to a certain point. There are smaller sensors than full-frame sensors. The full-frame sensors are expensive. The Canon 5D is a full-frame sensor. The Nikon D3 is a full-frame sensor, and now they have a D4. But these are big, expensive cameras. One of the things that makes them big also is not the size of the sensor, but the fact that they use mirrors. In the traditional way, film SLRs used mirrors. An SLR, or a digital SLR, SLR stands for single lens reflex, allow you to look through the viewfinder, and then you're looking through a prism out through the lens. And photographers love that because they're seeing exactly what they're going to get, right? But that requires a fairly elaborate Rube Goldberg device with a prism and stuff that has to be slid out of the way before the picture can be taken. That's why these mirror cameras have big chunky sounds, you know, chum, because there's a mirror going chump and getting out of the way. And that adds to the size of the body, the complexity, and a little bit to the cost. So we are seeing now mirrorless cameras, and there are even mirrorless cameras with full-frame sensors. Sony just released the first one, the A7 and the A7R. Pricey, but quite good. In fact, if your wife's is she pretty serious about photography? Are you really want some get some great pictures?
I think she's heading that direction. I mean, yeah. The main thing is you know, for doing some sports where the kids doing some nature vacations, but then I think she's going to take it from there. And so I don't want to buy anything cheap, but I don't want a professional. But maybe
you don't want to spend $4,000 either. I understand.
$1,200, $1,500.
Okay. Well, the A7 is about that. You do have to buy lenses, and there are a limited range of lenses right now. But the A7's the first full-frame mirrorless. Most mirrorless cameras use a smaller sensor called Micro Four Thirds, and that's pretty small. There's something in between called APS-C. There are a lot of very good APS-C cameras. Sony also makes the NEX series is a very good interchangeable lens, mirrorless system using the APS-C sensor. I happen to like, if your wife doesn't want to carry a big, heavy camera, is not worried about a full-frame sensor, and wants a wide variety of lenses. You said sports, they have nice telephoto lenses. Micro Four Thirds is actually not a bad choice. It is
okay.
It is a mature technology with lots of lenses. It's fairly inexpensive. My favorite Micro Four Thirds, although there are a great many of them, is the Olympus OMD. The EM5 or the newer EM1, a little more expensive. And the nice thing is you can get a basic zoom lens that gets you started, but as she gets more advanced, there's a really good range of Micro Four Thirds or MFT lenses out there. In the APS-C, there are quite good choices. And in the past, for years, I've recommended the Canon Rebels. These are kind of starter digital SLRs. They have mirrors. They have APS-C sensors, but they're less expensive. We're under $1,000 with lens. And these are quite good. And, of course, one of the things you should keep in mind is when you choose Nikon, Canon, Sony, you're kind of basically choosing to buy lenses from them. You can get adapters, but really it always works best to use the lenses from that manufacturer. So the difference is Micro Four Thirds is a standard that several manufacturers support, and that's why there's such a wide range of
right
choices.
But mirrorless would be better than opting for a full-frame sensor then?
Well, it just really depends on her needs. The full-frame sensor gives you two wonderful things. First, very good low-light performance if you have a good low-light lens. It also gives you something called bokeh. And this is what makes – sometimes people see this and they go, that's what makes it a professional photograph. When you're doing a portrait where you see the face of the person and the background is kind of blurry in the background, that to do that well – requires a larger sensor. You can't really do it on a point-and-shoot. The sensors are so small that you can't get kind of that big depth of field. The bigger the sensor, the more depth of field you get. You don't get great depth of field on a it's kind of confusing. Depth of field, more depth of field means everything's in focus. Less depth of field means only a certain plane is in focus. That's kind of what you want, or at least you want the control of that, and the bigger the sensor, the better. So a full frame is really the best if you want to have that. Does she do portraiture at all?
Not yet.
Yeah.
So, but it sounds like, you know, from a Micro Four Third standpoint, the OMD is probably the best.
I think, it's a great camera. It's compact. Lisa, my girlfriend, and I took twin OMDs to Europe on our last trip. We shared lenses. The bodies are inexpensive enough we could do that, and we got wonderful, wonderful images. Now, Chris probably or may have some changes to make. He may have his own opinions on this. I think certainly the Sonys are really an up-and-comer. The Sony NEX, I gave my son an NEX-7 for his high school graduation present. They're really great cameras. The new A7s and A7R, the A7R is probably not a good idea. It's a little pricey, but the A7... which is, I think, $1,200 for the body, is really excellent and is going to be, I think, a standard for some time to come. And then I'm a big fan of Micro Four Thirds. These are smaller sensors, but they are in many ways more flexible. Lots more lenses to choose from, compact bodies that really make it easy to carry around, and great images, really great images.
And with a Four Thirds, you're okay with sporting activities?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. In fact, she can get a nice long – with sports, what you want is a telephoto lens, a long lens, because you can't get close enough to really – you want to see the faces. And right. So you need a long lens. I mean, we're talking probably 200 to 400 millimeters. That's a big, long lens and a very expensive lens on a high-end DSLR, but you can get those fairly inexpensively, relatively inexpensively on the Micro Four Thirds.
Okay.
And there are some things to complicate this. For instance, the length of the lens, when we talk about a 200 millimeter lens, we're talking about it with a full frame sensor. When you go to Micro Four Thirds, it's half the sensor size. So the effective length of the lens is doubled. So a 200 millimeter lens on a full frame sensor is really a 400 millimeter on Micro Four Thirds. That's perhaps going a little confusing there.
All right. Nope, I follow you.
You call it the crop factor. The smaller the sensor, the longer the lens is. I think there are so many good choices. Digital photography has exploded, and there are excellent choices even in point-and-shoots. But I have to tell you, I think for just kind of all-around great camera with a great variety of lenses, the Olympus OMD series is really taking the cake. Just okay. Some nice stuff. And I think for her, this is probably a good choice. It's compact. It's light. Lisa loves hers. She just carries it everywhere with her.
All right. Well, I'll look at that in the Sony. Well, one thing on the Sony, we used to have a point and shoot, and they had those strange memory cards, like proprietary.
Yeah, not anymore. No, everybody uses SD cards now. Thank goodness.
Okay. Sony's not proprietary.
No more magic stick. That was far from magic. Hey, okay. Thank you. Stay tuned, because Chris Marquardt's coming up. He'll have some thoughts. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. There he is, Chris Marquardt, back from Iceland. And
in an original Iceland sweater.
Yeah, and your hair, you look like an Iceland pony. You've grown it out a little bit.
Chris, oh, well, we know things up.
You look good. Chris is our photo guy, a digital photography pro. And we were talking with Kevin about a camera for his wife. She wants to get a little bit serious. And I was just curious what your thoughts were on what we're talking about.
I don't have much to add. I mean, I would recommend start with a Micro Four Thirds. That's a wonderful format to start with. The cameras are relatively small because you don't have that mirror box that DSLRs have. The lenses are relatively small. The sensor size, yes, it's smaller, but it's not really super small. So you still get very decent quality. I know professional photographers use Micro Four Thirds cameras exclusively now. So there's nothing wrong with going for that. And the Olympus that you mentioned, the EM1 or the EM5 are both great cameras that have a great selection of lenses. So nothing wrong with that.
The EM1 is reduced in price now because they came out with the EM5. So it's well under 1,000, I believe. And lenses are fairly affordable. I think it's a great system to start with. You can get a basic zoom and go from there. So it's time, ladies and gentlemen, for our monthly photographic review. Each month we ask you to go out and take pictures to illustrate a word or a concept. And then Chris looks through them. They're all uploaded to Flickr, our special tech guy group on Flickr. In this case, our word was three, and Chris has picked three photos to take a look at. But I'm just looking at all of the pictures. We've got quite a few, and all of them are fun.
It was a tough choice this time.
Yeah.
A really tough choice. 111 entries this time.
Wow. A lot of people chose to have three items in the shot. That was one way they answered this conundrum.
Yeah, and I kind of chose pictures that had three items in them, apart from one that has the number three in it. But I like all of them, and it was not easy to choose. So the first one I chose was by Mitchell Evans, and the title is, not surprisingly, Three. And it has that human element in it, that it's a person showing three fingers into the picture, and the focus is on those three fingers. So you see the person in the background slightly blurred, a bit in the dark, but it tells a story. Those three fingers are in focus, and actually the tips are pretty bright, so that's where your eyes gets pulled in. And then from that point, you kind of start exploring the picture, and you end up on the face, and like, it's kind of a little cool gesture. And by the way, you would definitely be able to get this kind of a blurry, shallow depth of field, even with a Micro Four Thirds camera.
So that's what I was going to ask you, because we were talking about the bokeh and how the beautiful kind of blurry backgrounds you get with full-frame sensors. But you're saying that this kind of out-of-focus background with a crisp and focused foreground, even a small-frame Micro Four Thirds can do that.
It helps if you have a bit of a longer lens there. Like this would probably be, I have to guess, like a 50 to 100 millimeter lens. You'd step back a bit, zoom in a bit, and the longer focal length will help you get the background more out of focus. But this one, I'd definitely be able to do this with a Micro Four Thirds camera.
Yeah, she shot this with a Sony SLT A57 at 24 millimeters of a wide angle, f2.8, yeah.
The other thing that helps getting things in the background out of focus, if you get close to what's in the foreground and focus on that. So in this case,
She got real close to the fingers. Yeah.
So
the other thing I find interesting on this one is that she shot it in aperture, or he did, I guess it's Mitchell, shot it in aperture priority. And you do that so that you can choose what's in focus, right?
You pretty much gives you choice, not over what's in focus, that's the focusing, but it gives you the choice over how much is in focus. So a bigger aperture gives you more less in focus. If you crank the aperture to a smaller hole, then you have a bit more in focus.
Now we've got one that's in German from Greg Tramiek. Die drei Schwestern. What is that?
Die drei Schwestern. The three sisters.
Oh, I love this. This is in the snow, it looks like.
This is in the snow, snowy day. This was taken in March in Indiana. So
there you go.
It was not taken in Germany, but the title is German. It's one of those pictures that is so minimalistic. I mean, there's almost nothing in there. You see like a snowscape, and it's probably even snowing, because there's very little contrast. And then in the background, you see these three trees, and that's all you get in the picture. So it's very reduced.
Low contrast, too. You know, I might have been tempted to go for high contrast on this, but the trees are kind of fading out, and I like that. It's kind of mysterious.
It's very mysterious, and it's really intriguing. I would put this somewhere on the wall. I mean, this is one of those things you print out and put it up on a wall.
It's almost a Japanese
painting. And it saves a lot of ink when you print that.
Just a little dab of gray ink. Finally, our third shot from A. Peter is the number three, and it is a picture of a three all wrapped up in plastic, I guess about to go up on a sign or something.
Well, not just that, but it is one of those street scenes. If you look closely, there are two legs sticking out under the three, and
an arm sticking. A giant three.
Someone's carrying a three. Then you explore the picture a bit more, and to the right of it, there is the letter D. So there might be a 3D movie ad or something coming up. I don't know. But it's one of those things you explore. You see the three's upside down, so it looks wrong, and then you notice it's wrapped up, and then you see the people in the background, and the focus is pretty clear because that's the thing. You it's big in the picture, and you realize it. The only thing that's kind of in the way is the red thing sticking in from the side and the front. But then on the other hand, that's one of those spur of the moment pictures. You take that, you don't really think, you just take that picture because that's just there for a brief moment.
And this was taken with an iPhone, so really a lot of street photography nowadays is with that camera you have in your pocket.
Absolutely, and yeah.
Very nice iPhone shot. It looks like some Instagram-style filters were applied to it.
Yeah, probably, but it works for this picture.
Works well. Three nice shots. Thank you to all three of you. If you want to see all the shots, first of all, I just sent James DeRuvo the links, so all three shots are on our website, techguylabs.com, plus a link to all of the shots tagged three in our photo pool at the Tech Guy group on flickr.com, so you can see a lot of images with threes in them. This was fun. This was really a fun choice. I liked three. But now, Chris, it falls upon you to pick a new subject for this month.
Well, the new subject is flat.
Oh!
I don't think we've had that. But
no.
Could mean a lot of different things.
Flat. Yeah, we're not going to tell you either what it means. You're going to decide. That's part of the fun of it. What does flat mean to you? What would an image reflecting the idea or the word flat mean to you? What would it look like? Go ahead and take a shot. We don't care what kind of camera, obviously. Composition and color or lack of it, and all of that is what makes a difference in this shot. It doesn't matter what kind of camera you use. Go to the Flickr site. If you're not a Flickr member, you can create an account free. It's a Yahoo company, so if you have a Yahoo account, you have a Flickr account. And then make sure you join the Tech Guy group. Renee Silverman, our moderator, will welcome you. There are also weekly assignments and stuff. And it's not a contest. It's not about rewards or prizes. It's really about an excuse to go out and take some pictures. Flat. What would flat mean to you? I like that one, Chris. Good choice. Was it Finland or Iceland?
Iceland. It was cold. Well, that's why it's called Iceland, I guess.
Photographers love Iceland. It's something about it, huh?
It's amazing. There's so many contrasts there. The landscape is wild. The weather changes quickly. It's warm on one day, cold on the next. The aurora, the northern lights.
Did you see the northern lights?
We did. You can see some pictures at tfttf.com/Iceland2014photos.
tfttf.com/Iceland2014 2014 photos. While you're there, check out Chris's stuff. He does workshops. He's got a wonderful Discover Lightroom program, which I've been running through, discoverlightroom.com, and he joins us every week. Thank you, Chris. Hey, you, I got a question for you. You got some old gadgets lying around? I bet you do. Who doesn't? Look, let me just look up. Let me just reach into my drawer. What is this? A Galaxy Note 2. Just sitting there. Not doing anybody any good, just gathering dust. This is where you go to gazelle.com. GAZELLE.com. You can get cash, even for broken phones. Sell your iPhone, your iPad, your Mac, your Galaxy. I wonder what, you know, just out of curiosity. Here I have that Galaxy Note 2. Do you think that's worth anything at all? Let me see. Is this unlocked? Yeah, this is the unlocked European model. Let's see. Unlocked. Galaxy Note 2. Just like that one. This is flawless because I used it for about a month. $126. I'm holding my hands like that. Wow. iPhones, iPads, old computers. Go to gazelle.com. Now, here's the deal. I don't have to do anything about that. I've got 30 days. I've got 30 days to take advantage of that. So might as well get some more stuff out of your drawers or your closets or your storage locker and just pile it all up. Then when you pull the trigger, they will send you a prepaid postage box. So you don't pay anything on the postage. You send it in. They check the condition. They say, well, you know what, Leo? This is flawless. We're going to give you an extra $20 just because it's – and they actually do that. I've never heard a company doing that, but they do. They will also if you forget, wipe your data so you don't have to, you know, if you forget, you go, oh, forgot, because I always do. And they'll wipe the data for you. And then they'll send you a check or a PayPal credit. Or, and I think that this is the pro tip, if you are a Amazon regular, get that Amazon gift card and you get an extra 5% to pay for your Amazon Prime. The new $99 Amazon Prime. GAZELLE. Sell your gadgets the fast and easy way at gazelle.com. Find out why more than 700,000 happy customers have been paid more than $100 million to date at gazelle.com. Offers are good for 30 days. Postage is paid on anything worth more than a buck. They'll wipe your data if you forget to, and they'll send you cash fast. Gazelle.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know, really, it's fun to talk about cameras, and I spend way too much time talking about the technology of photography. It isn't about the technology. It's about the eye. The only reason I spend so much time thinking and talking about it, first of all, is because I'm the tech guy. It's kind of my job, but also because I'm not a great photographer. So I focus on the stuff I can control. But really, if you've got a great eye, whatever, you know, you can use an iPhone. You can use a $10,000 camera. If you've got a great eye, you're going to get a great picture. You really are. It's all about the ability to see and capture that magic image. 8888 Ask Leo. Kelsey is next. Hi, Kelsey. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from London.
London, England. Nice to talk to you.
That's okay. Right. So I've got here an X7, an iPhone 4S, and a Windows 8.1 laptop.
Okay.
Which, basically, I'm using screen reads because I'm blind boy and I can't use screen, obviously, so I've got screen reading on the Nexus, screen reader on the iPhone, screen reader on the laptop.
Do you use JAWS on Windows? What do you use on your Windows machine?
I use JAWS on my Windows and then the TalkBack on Nexus and VoiceOver on the iPhone.
So the built-in accessibility features on the iPhone and the Nexus are sufficient for you?
Yeah, definitely.
Good. Do you have an opinion which is better?
I've had the iPod. I use an iPod Touch since the beginning of 2013, I want to say. Yeah, 2013. And then I got the Nexus beginning of this year. So I haven't had that quite as long. But I do really like iPhone VoiceOver because TalkBack, which is on the Nexus, is still in development. It needs a lot of improvement. But
that's always been my impression, is that Apple's done a great job with accessibility on their iOS stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's more enclosed, so it's obviously more going to be sort of Apple are going to, in their own apps, are going to be able to implement it a lot easier than Android are.
Right. So what can I help you with?
Right. So what I want to do, I've got obviously the Nexus, the iPhone and Windows. I want to be able to sync contacts and calendars and whatnot between obviously the People app on Windows 8 and the Calendar app and Google and Apple. And I'm finding it very difficult without ending up with some error or some...
Yeah, the Google and Apple part is easy. You just use Google. Google Contacts,
yeah.
Google Calendar. All of that works great on iPhone and Android phone. It's Windows. That's the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
And do you want to get it into Outlook? Is that what you'd like to use as your application on Windows?
No, the Windows 8, what is it, Windows 8 Mail and...
The built-in stuff.
Yeah. Because when you put Google into the Mail app, it doesn't use people, when you use people, it doesn't do anything.
Yeah, and there's some debate over whose fault this is. Microsoft says it's Google's fault because Google stopped supporting the Exchange Active Sync, EAS, that Microsoft uses to sync. And so Microsoft said, see, Google doesn't like, you know, Google's being anti-competitive. Google said, even Microsoft doesn't support this anymore. We shouldn't have to support it. It's up to Microsoft to support industry standards like, I don't know what it would be, CalDAV or vCards or whatever. There are a lot of standards. So I don't know who, I don't want to ascribe blame here, but it is tricky. Jeff Needles in the chat room has given us a link to Microsoft's own page on how to sync Google services with Windows. I will put that in the show notes for you, Kelsey. It's a long URL, but you could probably Google Microsoft.com, how to sync Google services with Windows. And this is for Windows 8.1. To sync your contacts from the Mail app or the People app, it says you can connect to your Google account, but first, you have to remove any accounts that have a needs attention notification. I suspect that that's because of the change standard from Google. Microsoft had some accounts that were messed up as a result. You got to take those out and basically start over. Does that make sense, Kelsey? It does sound like that now, whatever Google's doing, Microsoft does support in the Mail app and the People app on Windows 8.
They don't want to make it easy for you.
Yeah. Now, have you upgraded to Windows 8.1?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. I think everybody who uses 8 should definitely go to 8.1. And 8.1 update 1 is going to come out probably in a month or two. That will also be something to upgrade to. I think you'll have better results with the 8.1. It sounds to me, and I'm going to have to do some research, sounds to me like either Microsoft blinked or Google blinked. Somebody blinked and made it possible. And that's good, because in the past you've had to buy third-party apps to do this, and it was just crazy. So apparently, as long as you don't have any blocked accounts, any accounts that say needs attention, you can just do this. If you do, delete those accounts and basically start over. In fact, it might be that's the easiest thing to do in general. Just delete any Google accounts you now have in the People or Mail app and just re-add them, and it should work. Sounds like they've done something in 8.1 that makes it work better. Thank you. Good to talk to you, Kelsey. I appreciate it. Moving on to Jonathan in Hollywood. Hello, Jonathan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Jonathan. Did I push the button? I did. I don't hear any sound. That always worries me when it's quiet. I'm going to put Jonathan on hold and see if it's something I'm doing. I'll go to Sendar in Maryland. Sendar, are you there?
Hello, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Excellent.
It's my second call in as many years. First time you helped me, sync my contacts with Google account.
Excellent.
Thanks for helping me. You know, it really helped me.
Good.
At that time, I was a novice in the smartphone. Now, I'm a little better. I have a question today for you, Leo. It's about Samsung Galaxy Note 2.
Okay.
Off late, there's a lot of lag in my phone. It's very painful to use. It just loads very slowly, and apps, you know, take longer time to load. And I'm thinking of rooting my phone, but it is still in warranty. I need your advice, expert.
There are a couple of things that happen with smartphones. I mean, one is just you get a lot of apps on there, and maybe a few apps are slowing it down. So it's always a good idea, and I know it's a pain, but with Android phones, it's not a huge pain, to just start over. Go to the, you know, delete everything, reset, get a factory refresh, and see if that helps. But there's another issue that goes on with smartphones. The storage is on solid-state devices. And you know that solid-state devices slow down over time. And as a smartphone or any SSD drive gets older, it slows down. And I think I certainly noticed this on the original Nexus 7. It was a big deal. And actually, Google responded to it in Android 4.3 by adding something called Trim, which is an operating system command that solves this SSD slowdown problem. Are you up to 4.3 on your Note 2 yet?
Yes, Leo. I just upgraded from 4.1.2.
Okay. So there are programs that will force it, like LagFix, which is on the Play Store. That kind of forces Trim. But my experience with the Nexus 7, when I went to 4.3, within a day or two, this was the original Nexus 7, it was light years faster. It solved all the lag. So I'm wondering if that is the problem. So there's two things I'm recommending. One is a reset, but this other is make sure you have Android 4.3 on there. That enables Trim support. That's the ability of an SSD to kind of get back to the speed it was when it came from the factory. And then if it's not happening, then there's a program called LagFix that you can download from play.google.com. I don't know if you need root or not to use that. You might. But I've used it, and it really does make a difference. Yeah, you do have to have root. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers, the cell phone, home theater, the internet, digital photography, and all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO is the number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. Outside the U.S. and Canada, you can Skype us. In fact, we just had a call, didn't we, from London, England. I didn't ask Kelsey, but I think he was calling via Skype, I would guess. Did you ask?
Yeah, it was via Skype.
It was Skype, yeah. So when you use Skype Out, which is the ability to call a phone from Skype, and you call a toll-free number, it doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to have any credit in your Skype Out account, I think. So that's kind of cool. 888-827-5536, a toll-free number, and in the U.S. and Canada. And our website is techguylabs.com. Good thing to remember. TechGuyLabs.com has not only the phone number there, but a link to our great chat room and a lot more, including audio and video of previous shows, questions, and my answer. And if you have a thought as I answer a call and you have, you got it wrong, Leo, you can also go there and comment. All of that free and open. Always, forever, TechGuyLabs.com. I should sing happy birthday, shouldn't I? Happy birthday. The web, the World Wide Web, is 25 years old this week. Although, I think normally you count from the birth of something, right? That's how, because it wasn't the birth of the World Wide Web, but the twinkle in Tim Berners-Lee's eye. Tim Berners-Lee is a particle physicist. He was working in Geneva at CERN. He's a Brit. He's from the UK, but he was working in Geneva at the Geneva Particle Accelerator, CERN, in 1989, I guess it was. And he was a little frustrated by the way scientists were sharing their research and their papers with each other. He felt like it was just hard to use. So he wrote a proposal in 1989, March 12th, 1989, a document he distributed to colleagues at CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research in Geneva. It was called Information Management, a Proposal. And it had some diagrams and ideas. He said, we have vast quantities of information stored on our computers, but they're all over the place. Wouldn't it be cool if we could use the internet?" And the internet did exist, by the way. I saw a number of news organizations with headlines like, "The internet celebrates its 25th birthday." No, the internet's it's 50 years old. It's much older. It's the World Wide Web that's celebrating its birthday. He had a network at CERN. Everything was networked together. And the internet existed and was chiefly used at the time by educational institutions. But he wanted to put something on top of the internet, a way to link documents together, he said, using something called hypertext. The idea of hypertext wasn't even new. It had already been talked about and even implemented by others. The idea that you would have, say, a text in a document, and a word, you could click on a word and you would see footnotes or additional information about that word. You know, what we think of as links on the World Wide Web. So he thought about this, a networked hypertext system with all the papers there. He also, at the time, thought about the ability to annotate it. So the original World Wide Web, not only could you jump around from paper to paper by clicking links, but you could also annotate those pages, and the annotations would survive. Now, I say it was the twinkle in his eye because that was March 12th that he wrote that paper, but it wasn't until more than a year later that they coined the name World Wide Web, November 12th, 1990. And it wasn't until Christmas Day, 1990, that they had the first World Wide Web browser working. Pure text, wasn't graphical. He created it on a Next computer. You remember the Next computers? That was the computer Steve Jobs created after he was fired at Apple. He later came back to Apple and transformed the company. But at the time, that's why he called it Next. It's my Next computer. It was a beautiful machine, a cube. And Tim Berners-Lee was able to very quickly get his idea up and running from his proposal in November 1992, the first software implementation Christmas Day. So I think really you've got to say Christmas Day 1990 is really the birth date of the World Wide Web. And it wasn't publicly used until August 6th, 1991. People outside of CERN got access. And, of course, it was 2 years after that that the web really took off because of a couple of guys named Mark Andreessen and Eric Binna. They wrote a browser, Mosaic, that allowed you to have graphics as well as clickable text. I don't know if you remember the first time you saw the World Wide Web, the first time you saw a browser. But it was pretty amazing. I was using the internet at the time, back in the 80s, and it was all text-based. You used programs like Gopher and Archie. Gopher was a menu system that you'd use to navigate your way around the internet. No, there weren't websites at the time. And Archie was a system you could use to grab files and download them. But I very vividly remember my first experience of the World Wide Web. Must have been, I'm guessing, around 1991 or 92 with a text-based browser called Lynx. And then the first time I used Mosaic, and that just blew me away because it had graphics. It had animated GIFs. I remember a little compass where the needle was moving. I couldn't believe it. I rubbed my eyes. I said, what? 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 So I think it's safe to say that it was 25 years ago that the World Wide Web was a twinkle in Sir, he has been knighted since, Sir Tim Berners-Lee's eye. And its birth, though, was Christmas Day 2 years later. Anyway, happy birthday to the World Wide Web. Do you remember your first use of the World Wide Web, the first use of a browser? What a transformation that was. And I think it's important to make the distinction between the internet and the World Wide Web. We use the World Wide Web a lot, but we also use the internet. Skype, for instance, is on the internet, not the World Wide Web. I think people confuse that a lot. Web pages, websites, that's the World Wide Web. But a lot of what we do on the internet, sending email, for instance, is not the World Wide Web. You might use a web browser to look at your email, but email is transported differently, not through the World Wide Web. So isn't it amazing that it's only been 25 years, and really 23 years, that we've had this technology and what it's turned into? The earliest days of the web, it was aggressively non-commercial. It didn't... you couldn't... In fact, it wasn't until, I think, 1994 that you could put any commercials on there. Boy, that was a big change. Can you imagine a website without belly fat ads and Punch the Monkey and all those clickable banners? That changed a lot. I think it's a great thing to think about, a great thing to acknowledge. Certainly, we should honor Sir Tim Berners-Lee. He could, by the way, continues to work on the web. He runs a group called the World Wide Web Consortium that approves web standards and so forth. So he's very much involved in this. And he gave a little talk on the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. in which he pushed for the freedom of the web. And I agree. He's a proud father, obviously. He says, he told CNN, I have a certain amount of inventor's pride, and my greatest pride has been the spirit of collaboration we've had for the last 25 years. He says, at 25, it's kind of like a young adult. Suddenly it needs its independence. Young adults are at the stage where they're looking for freedom, asserting their rights, and that's what we need on the World Wide Web. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Happy birthday, www. So this is what do they call it? Pick Day? Selection Sunday in March Madness, the NCAA tournament. And in studio with me, what's your name, sir?
Kevin Horsch.
Kevin's in studio with me. He is a fan of Wichita State. And, of course, I got to think they're favorites in the tournament because they're 34-0.
Right, ranked number two.
Who's number one? Some other team. We don't need to talk about them. Well, you should be. Do you watch this on TV, Selection Sunday, or is there?
I'll probably catch it.
Is it like the Powerball drawing where they're basically random drawing, right?
No.
It's computerized. Muckety mucks. Have you ever used an iPhone app called Secret or Whisper? You have to have secrets to share. Maybe that's why. You don't have any secrets to share. Probably.
I'm an open book.
It is the latest thing sweeping Silicon Valley. The idea of Secret is you install it, it looks at your contact list, and then it allows you to share secrets anonymously. But because it knows your contact list, as the secrets are shared, Secret will show you whether the secret comes from a friend of a friend, or somebody else. So you can actually look at Secret and see secrets being shared, and it might say, this came from a friend. And what? And some of these secrets are pretty salacious. Some of them are just like, I hate Secret. A lot of the secrets are about, because it's Silicon Valley, right, and early adopters, they're about Silicon Valley. And it's an interesting phenomenon that's happening. First of all, it's highly... Are you installing it? You can't. It's on Android. It's on iOS.
No, I can't.
Android secrets.
Damn.
Don't install it. It's so addictive. You can't stop. You know, you don't want to.
Other people's secrets.
Well, that's it. And I have to tell you, it's pretty adult in some cases. A lot of times it's not. And sometimes it's just like false tips. I saw one last week. I work for Newsweek, and we're going to retract the Bitcoin story. That wasn't true. But it's anonymous, so you could put anything in there you want. Right now, there's a category of anonymous apps. And there's a big debate going on. We were talking about Mark Andreessen, the creator of Netscape. He's become a venture capitalist. And lately he's been using his Twitter feed, P-M-A-R-C-A, to soapbox on stuff. And he is soapboxing right now about anonymous apps, particularly Secret, that are, quote, designed to encourage negative behavior, tearing people down, making fellow souls sad. Turns out a lot of the traffic on Secret is negative. A lot of it's negative about him, I might add. I'm sorry, Mark, if you're sad. You shouldn't be sad. But it's one of those apps you just can't stop looking at. And it is certainly a very, very hot app right now. Whisper, which is earlier and predates it, didn't quite take off. And I think the big difference with Secret was this using your contact list so that you can see friends of friends. You can then comment on somebody's secret, also anonymously. And you can also heart it, favor it. And so you'll see secrets that other people have favorited because they get so many favorites, they become part of Secret in general. Here's one from a friend of a friend. Been reading articles about how nasty Secret is. Slander, bullying, lies, misogyny. Remember, journalists, what you see here depends on who your contacts are. Maybe you just know terrible people.
I'm glad you edited yourself.
Yeah. They're, I'm telling you, this is adult. Yeah, this is adult. Here's something from somebody, not a friend, but in California. I see something on Secret that makes me cry almost every day. At first, when I started using Secret, it was dumb. People were sharing shallow, dumb secrets. But something changed in the last few weeks, and now people are sharing some pretty serious stuff, but they're also using it to slam other people, to say bad things. A lot of sex talk, of course, as you might expect. And there's a real debate over whether this is a good idea. Now, I think part of the reason venture capitalists are debating it is not that moral high ground that Mark Andreessen is talking about, but the fact that they talk about venture capitalists a lot and they say bad things about them, much of which is probably untrue. You cannot stop reading it, though. I have to. Andreessen says, I never like to criticize any startup, and I won't in this thread by name on Twitter. We obviously know what he's thinking of, though, his Secret. But there is an important topic that must be discussed. And it's an interesting question. Does software modify behavior? In other words, if an application like this encourages bad behavior because it's anonymous and it's kind of fun, and can it make you a bad person? Or does it just tap into the bad person that you already are? It kind of goes back to the video game question. Do violent video games make people violent? I've always been of the opinion that that's not the case, because I play a lot of video games, and most video games are violent. I don't think I'm a violent person, but I have to say, if you were maybe on the edge, it would kind of give you permission. Oh, it's, you know, maybe a little bit more okay to be that way, nasty, rude, or violent.
But they can give you bad dreams.
Video games definitely give you bad dreams. Yeah. Okay. My serious advice: do not play for 6 hours right before bed.
Horrible idea.
There's a new game just came out. And, of course, when it's a new game, everybody, you know, this is what you do. You binge on it. And it's called Titanfall. Came out this week. Finally, a new title, an exclusive title for Microsoft's Xbox One. And everybody's been very excited because we haven't really had anything very exciting for the Xbox One. It's a shoot 'em up. You're a space marine running around in environments. It's from the same people who wrote the original Call of Duty. But the only, and there's some differences. You can jump really well. You can run on walls. That's fun. Kind of like parkour. You can just run around on walls. But the big difference is there's Titans in it. That's hence the name Titanfall. These are giant robot suits. Did you see Pacific Rim? Kind of like the robot suits in Pacific Rim, where you get in and suddenly you're super, and you can do Hulk smash and stuff like that. These games are, I think, appealing because they're escapist. And we all, you can't deny this. Every once in a while I have the urge to Hulk smash somebody or something. I want to Hulk smash my smartphone fairly frequently. And so when a video game gives you that, and it's a cartoon, we know it's not real. In that outlet, I don't think that's a bad thing. Do you think, though, I think it's a good question, and certainly this is the question that Mark Andreessen raised on Twitter, that games can influence, or programs in general, can influence human behavior. Do you think because of Facebook and Twitter, we are different? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll talk about it right after this. Well, we just keep hearing more and more about the capabilities of the National Security Agency, the NSA, to spy on us. And the latest, a story published, I guess, on the 12th, a couple of days ago. More Edward Snowden leaks. By the way, how do you feel about those leaks? Do you think that those are real? I have to say that the breadth and depth of the information makes me think that these are not being made up. And at least in some cases, independent corroboration indicates this is probably, these are real. These slides that Edward Snowden's leaking are real. The NSA admits he was a contractor. He had access to this information. They even said how he got it with an off-the-shelf data sucking tool that he ran on the NSA's network to download all sorts of stuff. Stuff he was, in fact, theoretically not allowed to access, but could. He says he has millions of documents, and he's slowly releasing them to the press. The most recent, published at The Intercept, talks about an NSA program called Quantum. And The Intercept, which at firstlook.org is a publication that's really been kind of created to release all this information, says that this Quantum tool weaponizes the internet. It is a malware tool that can infect machines at an industrial scale. This is from the slide, the words industrial scale exploitation. The agency has tools, has malware tools that can infect potentially millions of computers worldwide with implants that allow them to eavesdrop on the computer's owner, covertly record audio from the computer's microphone, take shots from the computer's webcam. Now, the NSA says, well, don't worry. We're only going to use it on foreign nationals suspected of terrorism. But I get the feeling that the way the NSA thinks on this is, well, let's just infect everyone in case. And then if we need to, there's no problem. We just turn it on and we can see what they're doing. We won't use it if we don't have to, but when the time comes, we will. Quantum, according to these slides, was originally used on just a few hundred very hard-to-reach targets. They couldn't monitor their communications through traditional wiretaps, so they developed this malware program to get malware on their computers that would allow them to spy on these people without wiretaps. But the NSA, according to these documents, has aggressively accelerated these hacking initiatives of the last 10 years, automating these tools. Usually, or in the past, it was by hand. A human had to, you know, create an email with a payload and, you know, one by one infect machines. But now they've got an automated system codenamed Turbine designed to allow the NSA to target literally millions of machines automatedly. Now, you cannot tell me that they have millions of targets. They're not infecting millions of machines because they have a list of millions of terrorists they need to watch. That's not how it works. They're targeting millions of machines just in case. Just in case. The NSA describes a pre-programmed part of the covert infrastructure called the Expert System, which is designed to operate like a brain. It manages the applications and the functions of the implants and decides which tools they need to best extract data from infected machines. In other words, they just install us on everything, and then we'll use these specialized automated intelligence tools to get information when we need it. Mikko Hopponen, who is I've talked about him before. He's a security expert, head of the Finnish security firm F-Secure. Talks about these techniques. He says when they deploy malware on systems, they potentially, and this is one of the real risks. There's the risk of being spied upon, of course, but maybe even a bigger risk is they potentially create new vulnerabilities in these systems, making them more vulnerable for attacks by bad guys. See, when you spread millions malware onto millions and millions of machines, those millions and millions of machines now have vulnerabilities of their own that are new, that have been introduced by the malware. And should bad guys figure out what they are, now they've got new targets for their attacks. Microsoft's always patching Windows, right, to find those holes. Does the NSA spend the same amount of energy protecting us and our machines that are infected by NSA malware? Hipponen says governments could arguably justify using malware in a small number of targeted cases against adversaries. I don't think anybody would argue against that. If you knew Osama bin Laden wasn't using Skype, but we could get to his computer, well, I think everybody would agree. Then we could, that'd be a great way to spy on him. Nobody would disagree. But millions of malware implants being deployed by the NSA as part of an automated process would be out of control, he says. That would not be proportionate. He says it couldn't possibly be targeted and named. It sounds like wholesale infection and wholesale surveillance. The NSA didn't respond directly, but they did point to President Obama's most recent policy directive of January 17th, in which the president said, signals intelligence, this kind of intelligence gathering, shall be collected exclusively where there is a foreign intelligence or counterintelligence purpose to support national and departmental missions, not for any other purposes. Okay, but why would you develop a tool that would infect millions of computers in that case? Wouldn't it be sufficient to hand target the individuals? And this is the real issue that gets raised by all of this NSA surveillance. I understand and I believe that the NSA and these other agencies are patriots. They're doing everything they can to protect us against terrorist attack. It's their mission. It's their job. But I also believe that they have capabilities, and they've worked very hard to develop these capabilities that go far beyond their mission. Their response is not, no, we don't have these. Their response is, it's okay, trust us. We won't use these inappropriately. And, you know, for the most part, I do. These guys and gals are patriots, and I believe they really are trustworthy for the most part. The thing that I fear is that once a tool like this is in use, you can have rogue operatives within the intelligence agencies spying on ex-girlfriends. Or perhaps it could leak out to other agencies like the IRS, who could use this to gather tax information. There certainly is a history, recent history, of agencies like the FBI being used to target political enemies. Richard Nixon used the FBI this way. J. Edgar Hoover had a massive dossier on Martin Luther King. He felt the civil rights advocate was a terrorist threat. Imagine if they'd had those kinds of tools then, what kind of information they could have gathered and on whom. It also raises the issue of maybe you trust the government today, but just, you know, in 10 years, things could change. You can't take back those tools. You can't take back those infections. Oh, we don't trust the government now. Too late. Too late. And then there's this larger issue, which Chaponin raised, I think a good issue, of does this open vulnerabilities on all our machines to real bad guys? This is a scary thought. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, our musical director, Nathan Staten, doing it again. I love the stuff he picks. Thank you, Nathan. Good job. Our call screener today, Kim Schaefer. She's had the last hour off because our phone system is dead completely, but that's okay. Are you enjoying yourself just sitting around?
I am. Yeah? I'm enjoying myself reading all the chat.
We do have a great chat room, don't we?
Yeah, they're fun.
They're very helpful.
Very flattering.
Yeah? Oh, they love you. They love you. That's because they haven't seen a girl in years.
Are you accusing them of all being very geeky?
Most of them are in their mother's basement. I'm just saying. No, I'm kidding.
I'm sorry.
They're great people. You're very attractive, and of course, they're hitting on you because that's what guys do on the internet. That's what the internet was made for. Guys, knock it off. It's my job. Kim, unfortunately, will not be with us after this week. Heather Hammond comes back from Africa. But come back again soon. It was great having you.
I will. I might just have to pop in some weekend.
Anytime.
I'm up here all the time.
Say hi to the nerds. You know, somebody asked me, because we were talking about surveillance, and they said, well, you know, Google's watching you all the time, your internet service provider. What about people who walk around with those Google glasses that got cameras on them? I've been wearing a camera from a company called Narrative. It's a clip on camera that takes pictures every 30 seconds of what I'm seeing. We're all walking around these days with cameras. We're all kind of under surveillance by everybody else, aren't we? But there's a difference between what Google knows about you and can do with that information and what the government knows about you and can do with that information. Google doesn't own tanks. Google doesn't own drones. Well, maybe they do, but they're not weaponized drones. Let's put it that way. And I fear government more than there is certainly a lot of privacy intrusion happening. And we really do need to deal with this. But I think the privacy intrusion of a government is much, potentially much more dangerous than the privacy intrusion of a company. What can Google do with the information it has about me? And by the way, I use Google services. I think Google is pretty upfront about what they collect. You can go to google.com/dashboard, see what they know, what they've been collecting. And they're pretty upfront. Here's what do we do with it? We use it to target you with advertising. A lot of people say, oh, that's terrible. It's not that bad. Wouldn't you rather have an ad that is for something you're interested in than something you're completely not interested in? Is that the end of the world? Are they somehow violating my freedoms by giving me an ad that's something I might be interested in? I don't think so. There's always the theoretical risk, and people will bring this up a lot too, that Google will start selling this personal information, for instance, to your insurance company. Leo eats an awful lot of donuts, and he's always searching for recipes for caramel corn. You should definitely raise his rates. I don't think that's happening, and I guess it could happen. I'm not... They raise my rates anyway all the time, don't they? I don't know if that's... Is that really the worst thing that can happen? The other thing that is a big difference is you don't have to use Google. You have a choice. If the government's spying on you, really your only choice is to disconnect from the internet, stop using credit cards, and move to somewhere where there are no drone overflights. It's pretty hard to get away from, you know, that kind of surveillance for good reason, because that's exactly what terrorists do. So, you know, we've got to develop ways to get to them. In fact, if you've got nothing to fear, why is it you are doing that? Maybe we should pay more attention. By the way, that's another thing the government does. They've even said this. If you make attempts to protect your privacy from us, for instance, if you go to my personal site, Leoville, LeoVille.com, you'll see I publish on that site my PGP key, my encryption key. That's a key that's public. Anybody can use it. And if you have the proper software on your machine, you can send me a message, a private message, using that key, encrypted with that key, that only I can read. I have the private key. I publish a public key. Use that public key. Encrypt your message. I get it. The public key can't decrypt it. The only thing that can unscramble that message is my own private key, which I keep firmly to myself. And as far as we know, and I believe this to be true, that no governmental agency, certainly no corporate agency, can read that message. It's private. So what does the NSA say about that? If you use this encryption, we're going to presume you're up to no good, and we are going to gather everything. If you make an attempt to communicate privately, we're going to assume that you're doing something wrong. We may not be able to read it, but we're going to collect it all. Wow. Wow. That's why everybody, frankly, should encrypt, I think. And by the way, don't you think the bad guys know all this stuff? Don't you think they're able? It always gets me. Same thing with copy protection and everything. These schemes only work against good, honest folk. These invasion schemes, because the bad guys know what to do. They know how to use encryption, and they use it. All right, we're going to take a break. I'm sorry, that's a downer. I'll think of something nice and happy and fun to talk about, because it is kind of a downer. But it's something I think we need to be aware of. And I mean, frankly, if you want to do something about it, I don't want you to feel disempowered. There is something you can do. Call your member of Congress, period. Don't send them an email, because they really need to know that you're coming from their district. So snail mail's fine. They can see the postmark. Or call them. And every member of Congress has somebody answering the phones. And you could say, hey, I just want Congressman Peters to know when the Patriot Act comes up for renewal next year, I want him to vote no. I am seriously concerned about privacy and government intrusion, and I want him to do everything he can to limit that. Something like that. Then they got to box the checkbox. One of your constituents doesn't like this. when that number gets to 1,000 or 100,000, you think they'll pay attention? I think they will. That's the best way to handle all the money coming in there, all the lobbying. It's all about votes. If you want actually some directions about the kinds of things you should care about and maybe some of the language that you could use, and even a direction to the member of Congress that you should call, it's very easy. The Electronic Frontier Foundation makes this very easy, EFF.org, and they have a page, their action page, EFF.org/action, that talks about all of these issues. Stop the NSA fake fix. Massive surveillance exposed. Reject secret FBI backdoors in your communications. Reform computer crime law. Stop secret copyright treaties. All the things that you might care about. And if you want to take action, you know, on one of these issues, click the take action button. They'll find your member of Congress, and they'll even give you more information and a script you can use if you're kind of shy, that you can use and call your member of Congress and then they can hear what you think. I think this is a great site. I support the EFF. I give them a monthly donation. I think they do good work. EFF.org/action. See, you can do something about that. You don't have to sit there and take it. Call your Congress critter. Hey, thanks to our musical director, Nathan Staton. Thanks once again. You did a great job, Kim Schaefer. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week. More of your calls to Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.